Soldiers stood over the two twitching, still whole Bajimin, and finished the parting of heads from bodies. Failure to comply will result in arrest and imprisonment. Other soldiers gathered up the heads that had rolled and sliced off their left ears. The captain looked directly at Persantiger, only 30 feet separating them. Jemmy shoved Blaine sideways, only half a step but enough to nudge him behind a taller novice in front. The crown will compensate for lost slaves, and where new slaves cannot be supplied, a mutual recompense will be agreed. The captain took the wire loop from his belt and held it up while 6 ears were threaded onto it. They joined many more. You, the captain said, pointing at a small group of men and women huddled beneath an overhang in front of a cafe. Throw the bodies into the river. Their task here finished, the soldiers reformed into a tight line behind the captain. He took a small scroll from his pocket, consulted it, grunted, and then started walking briskly from the square.
What just happened?
Blaine breathed.
What did he mean?
Jemmy remained pressed tight against him as if shielding him from the sun. The two men in front of him glanced back, and Blaine could see even Persantiger turned around and looking down the line toward him. All pretense had gone. They still knew that he was Bajimin. Of course they did. And of course they would give him away, old prejudices driving them, instinct pulsing through their blood and souls more powerfully than the worship of the Four ever could. That was what made his real aims and intentions as a novice priest so meaningful and so important. No one would ever forget. Blaine prepared to run, squirming to free his hand from Jemmy's. Blinking, he saw the swords whisking through the air and parting skin, flesh, bone. Breathing, he heard the dull thuds of heads hitting the ground. He could almost smell the hatred, and he wondered why he'd ever believed that scent could be purged from his nose. A hand closed around his upper arm, holding him tight.
We have to go,
Persantiger said.
You have to hide. Gather around, everyone. Huddle in. We have a friend to return to Yaris Teague.
Blaine opened his mouth to speak, but found that the words would not come. Moving back through the city, up from the river and toward the mighty hill that was home to Yaris Teague and the Temple of Four, Blaine saw signs that every nightmare he had ever lived was coming to life. Close to Quanar's Corner, a popular place for public speakers and orators, 7 Bajumen were hanging from ropes strung over the lower branches of a sinkut tree. 6 were dead, and 1 still kicked her legs feebly. All of them were missing ears. People hurried by, a few throwing nervous glances at the hanging dead, but most just kept their heads down. A little farther on, they crossed a footbridge over one of the artificial canals snaking out from the river and into the city. Surrounded by his fellow novices, Jemmy closer than all of them, Blaine could not see much, but he could hear the collective gasp from his companions as they crested the bridge. Even Persantiger grunted, his deep old voice sounding a brief pause in their journey. Needing to know, Blaine edged closer so he could see down into the river below. It was clogged with bodies. Its gentle flow was halted, and piled against a silty bank at the tight corner downstream from them were dozens of corpses. All of them were naked. All Bajumen. They showed signs of terrible violence. Some were missing heads. Others were cut and hacked. None of them moved, but river things moved over them. Perhaps not yet even cold, the baser creatures of Quandis were already consuming these dead Bajumen and making their bodies home.
What's happening? Blaine said. Why?
Crimes against everyone, Jemmy said.
What crimes?
His voice was rising, but a glance from a couple of those around him silenced him. He had no choice but to place a deep trust in his new friends, and he could not betray that trust by giving himself or them away.
In one narrow street, blood smeared the stone pavement, lapped at by several straggly dogs. Beside a building undergoing restoration, three Bajumen sat against the scaffold, heads in their laps, signs tied around their necks. "Killer of princes," the signs said. Blaine did not understand. Shouts echoed through the streets. Some screams. Later, a few cheers. When they were finally close to Yaris Teague, Per Santiger ushered them on ahead, past the gates and up the steps carved into the hill.
"We're going to the Temple of Four," the priest said, already panting with exertion. "Safer there than Yaris Teague. More secure. And the guard will never enter that sacred place."
He hurried them all the way up the high hill until they reached the gates of the Temple of Four. They were already open as they so often were, a sign of welcome for any of the faithful who might care to visit. Once through, though, the old priest called out for the gates to be closed. They hurried inside, milling in the wide courtyard known as Four Square, and Blaine looked up at the four towers. The rising sun framed them so that it looked like the whole temple was aflame. Their shadows stretched out like the gods reaching long fingers across this city in turmoil. Per Ristolo emerged from a tall arched doorway in the shaded half of the courtyard, walking slowly with the aid of a stick. Yet he looked determined. Per Santiger gestured to the young priests to remain where they were, then went to meet him, and the two old priests stood conversing quietly while the trainees lingered in a small group. Even inside the walls of the Temple of Four, they kept Blaine in the center of their huddle. Blaine might have cried tears of joy if his heart had not been burning with rage.
"I have to know why," he said.
He shoved his way out of the group. Jemmy grabbed his arm to hold him back.
"Per Santiger told us to stay here," she said.
"And do nothing? Can't you see how scared he is?" Blaine said.
In truth, he wasn't sure if the old priest was showing fear or surprise or a shocked resignation at the things they had seen. It didn't matter. He shrugged Jemmy's hand from his arm and walked slowly across the courtyard, not quite approaching the two old priests, but getting close enough so that he could hear their exchange.
"Seen the fires myself from the towers, all across the city,"
Per Ristolo said.
"How many?"
Per Santiger asked.
"Too many to count."
"Rebellion?"
"Perhaps, but I think not,"
the older priest said. He saw Blaine's approach and caught his eye, but did not react. Whatever news they shared was too harsh for secrecy.
"I think massacre," he said.
His eyes glimmered with tears.
"What's happening?"
Blaine asked. Per Santiger threw a stern look his way, but his old companion placed a hand on his arm.
"More than anyone, he should know," he said. "There's no distinction within these walls, and that makes it a good place. But not everyone accepts that. We've known that forever. And now perhaps our openness will be put to the test."
"You have to hide,"
Per Santiger said to Blaine. "What's happening?"
"Exactly what you saw on your way back. A slaughter of Bajumen,"
Per Ristolo said.
"All across the city. On the Queen's orders, Bajumen whores killed Prince Aris and unmanned him, and word has spread that it was the start of an uprising by those low down."
"Word spread by whom?"
Blaine asked.
"Ah, that's the real question,"
Per Ristolo said.
"But there are fires all across the city and..."
Something banged against the gates. At the same time, Blaine saw a strange expression pass across Per Ristolo's face. It was a fleeting, shocking twist of his features into an almost animal snarl. And then Blaine realized that the priest was wincing in pain. Something dark flowed across the whites of the old priest's eyes. Darker than blood, deep as night. Then they were the pale yellow of age once more. Yet he was no longer the mumbling, befuddled old man Blaine had taken him to be. He was something else. He was strong. In the archway behind Per Ristolo, the shadows seemed to flow in response. Blaine's eyes opened wide. Phage. He'd heard whispers about these soldiers of the faith, but had never seen them, and therefore had never believed in them. Some said they were ageless creatures given long life, spending most of their time hibernating beneath the Temple of Four until called upon to protect against threats to the priesthood or attack its enemies. Other rumors suggested they were wraiths of dead priests. There were some tales of them being used in Blaine's lifetime, but eyewitness accounts were varied and confused, and the priesthood remained silent on the matter, even among themselves. Older myths told of greater conflicts, either expanded in the telling or relating stories whispered down through the generations. However, the rumors changed. The idea of magic behind them remained consistent. And whatever they had been, the Phage were here. Per Ristolo had summoned them, as if from nowhere. And they were wraiths, indeed. Shadows given substance. They hung back inside the archway, unnoticed by most of the novices in the foursquare. Blaine was close enough to see.
Per Santiger is right,
the ancient priest said to Blaine.
You should hide.
But it was too late.
I ordered the gates locked,
Per Santiger bellowed. His only answer was the heavy creaking of stiff hinges as the two wide, heavy gates swung inward, revealing the view of the city and river below. Far away, smoke rose from several unseen fires, caught and smeared across the sky by wind streams higher up. Closer, so close that Blaine could still see blood on their swords and sweat knotting their hair, stood six members of the city guard. Their captain was a short, squat woman, her braided hair curled in a bun and pinned with a pale blue blade to match the uniform colors of the guard. Her five soldiers were spaced behind her with weapons ready. They exuded authority, a casual confidence that was matched in the slow manner in which they walked into the temple grounds. The captain surveyed the courtyard, eyes lingering for a moment on the two elder priests. Then her gaze settled on Blaine. He saw nothing in her eyes. No triumph, no hate, no excitement or trepidation. Only a sense of duty. In a way that scared him more. She gestured toward Blaine. And as three of her soldiers walked toward him, she asked, Is he the only one?
Of course not, Per Ristolo said. You can see there are other novice priests all around you.
You know that's not what I meant.
He is one of us, Per Ristolo said. And the city guard are not welcome within the temple walls.
I'm not asking for your welcome, the captain said. Is he the only one? Blaine started backing away, even though he knew that if he turned and ran, they'd shoot him down with the small crossbows they kept primed on their belts. The captain motioned three of her men forward.
He's no longer Bajuman,
Jemmy shouted, and he wanted to deny that claim, scream in the faces of these guards and priests, that with his brothers and sisters dying in the streets, he was more Bajuman than ever before. Yet he also didn't want to die.
There'll be no murder on these grounds, Per Santiger said, voice low but carrying across the courtyard.
He stepped toward the captain, and she held up her hand, palm facing him. It's not murder, she said. It's orders.
Then why not do it yourself? Blaine asked. Or are you afraid I'll take your sword and stick it up your arse?
The three soldiers closing on him stopped, an almost comical look of shock on their faces. Even the captain appeared startled by his defiance. Perhaps he was the first Bajuman to talk back at her today, let alone fight. But fight he would. He knew it then, and he was prepared for it, although his stand would be brief. He'd spit and bite and punch, and when he felt the metal in his flesh, he'd fight until he couldn't fight anymore. That was why he was here, after all. He'd just never expected it to happen so soon. Blaine glanced at Per Ristolo again, and the dark seepage around the High Priest's eyes seemed to be shading his face, as if denying the sun access. Blaine's heart beat faster. I'm seeing it, he thought. I'm here, bearing witness, and I'm about to see. Magic. He was seeing magic. That thing he had never believed but always hoped was true. And it meant that he didn't fight alone. The specters in the arched doorway manifested, flowing across the courtyard, parting around the two elderly priests, and coming to a halt before the three soldiers advancing toward Blaine. They were heat haze, shadows, dust devils. They were dreams. They were real, and their reality meant that his sacrifices had not been for nothing, that his ambitions could be achieved. But first he must survive. Blaine couldn't discern their sexes. They moved like fluid creatures, graceful and silent, their weapons the most solid things about them, gleaming in sunlight and seeming to glow with something brighter and hotter. Long, thin, curved blades in their left hands, shimmering whips in their right, the tendrils made of fine chains that flexed with a life of their own. Their armor was pale and supple, like thick leather, and where exposed, their skin was inlaid with tattooed designs that made it difficult to focus on them. Camouflage, perhaps. Or maybe something more.
We desire no conflict, Per Ristolo said.
It was clear that he commanded these phage warriors in some way, and he made no attempt to hide the fact. Blaine had thought Per Ristolo just an old, decrepit priest, a teacher. But if he controlled magic, he had to be one of the High Order. The guard soldiers and their captain had plainly never seen anything like the phage, and they stared wide-eyed at these warriors arrayed against them. Yet their training was strong and their sense of duty remained. This isn't conflict, the captain said, a touch of strain in her voice.
If your soldiers don't stand down, this is defiance of the crown. The crown's military doesn't have any place, jurisdiction, or rights on temple grounds. The queen knows that. You know that.
I know what's happened, the captain said. She took a step forward, sword drawn, and her troops followed.
I had nothing to do with it, Blaine said.
Your people did.
How many times do I have to tell you? He's our people,
Per Ristolo said.
Captain, you know as well as I that provenance should have no bearing on how one is perceived, don't you?
The captain froze and glared at the priest.
I see outlander features in your face,
Per Ristolo continued.
You're shorter than most Quandians, more heavily built, your skin a shade or two darker, though you use pigments. Somewhere in your past, perhaps not your parents, but your grandparents' generation for sure, one of your ancestors lay with someone from beyond the ring.
The captain glared.
From the far south, I'd guess,
Per Ristolo said.
The Hotlands.
I'm going to count to three, the captain said, and now her simmering anger was plain. It was not against Quandian law to have children with someone from the ring or the lands far beyond, so long as they had not been brought to Quandis as a slave. But questioning someone's background, even suggesting this was an issue, was a certain way to cause offense.
Consider your actions carefully, outlander,
Per Ristolo said. One. Blaine felt the eyes of the novices upon him. They had withdrawn to the edge of the courtyard, leaving him exposed close to its center, the phage and guardsmen before him. He wanted to look over and spare Jemmy a brief smile, but he dared not look away.
Two.
Whatever happened next would be fast. If fighting began, he would run for the archway from where Per Ristolo and the phage had appeared. He knew where it led. The Temple of Four. There were 100 places to hide.
Three,
the captain said.
Take him.
It was even faster than Blaine had expected. As the soldiers of the city guard stepped forward, the phage seemed to flow, moving like breath on the breeze. As they attacked, they and their weapons grew more solid and defined. Metal clashed, and someone cried out. Blaine didn't even have a chance to run, frozen in place until Per Santiger pulled him down. From that position, all he heard was a grunt, a thud, and the impact of someone falling. He tried to watch 3 points of combat at once, but at each, 2 guards took on 1 phage, the fighting fast and furious, and he could make very little sense of anything. Per Santiger crouched beside Blaine, wincing as his old joints creaked. He grasped his student's face between old, gnarled hands.
Run and hide, he said. You and the other priests who were once Bajumen, find them all, run with them, and hide. Go now.
Jolted from his shock, Blaine rushed for the doorway, expecting a crossbow bolt in his back at any second. None came. At the opening, he paused and looked back, past the bodies on the ground, past the violence cutting the air, to Jemmy and the others. Every one of them had stood with him, and for that he owed them everything. Jemmy raised a hand, and Blaine waved back. Then he ducked inside and was welcomed by the temple's cool interior. He lost sight of the chaos outside, and soon he could no longer hear it. The heavy walls of the temple swallowed the sound, and they would swallow him, too. Blaine already knew where he needed to go. News of the slaughter of the Bajumen must have been spreading rapidly through the priesthood. Minutes after entering the shadowy temple proper, Blaine rounded a corner and ran into a small group of novices. Most of them were Bajumen. Frightened, like him, wide-eyed and lost, they had heard what was happening, but they hadn't seen what he had seen. Most of the teaching took place down in Yaris Teague. But this group must have been summoned to the Temple of Four for some lesson or another. Blaine's was the only group of novices who had left Temple Hill today, and he was lucky to still be alive. There were 5 Bajumen in the group, and a few more Kwandians. No instructor. In these desperate hours, they had been sent on their own to find somewhere to hide.
Into the libraries, Blaine said. Through the general sections and—
Who are you to tell us?
A woman asked. She looked older than Blaine, and he could tell from her robes and the chain she wore that she was more advanced in her training.
Someone who's seen, was all he said.
His haunted eyes must have convinced her because she and the others nodded.
I know a place, the woman said. A scroll chamber, sealed from the outside to maintain a dry atmosphere. The entrance is well hidden down behind the History of the Ring section.
She frowned at Blaine.
You'll be coming?
Of course, he said, at the same time thinking, of course not.
He knew of a far better hiding place, but he would share it with no one. They set off, passing through some living quarters, kitchens, and a dining area, wending their way through the interior of the temple and toward its northern edge. They left the courtyard and violence far behind, but Blaine could still hear the sound of metal on metal, and see the phage dancing on sunlight as they attacked. To protect me. Whatever else he might think of the priesthood and their outdated beliefs, at least they were true to their word. He felt a pang of affection for grumpy old Per Santiger, and then a cool flush of concern as he wondered whether the priest was even still alive. News like that would have to wait until much, much later. As the group passed through a courtyard overgrown with lush grape plants and orchid poles, Blaine slipped away. No one saw him go. Even if they had, it would not have mattered. Bajumen had learned to mind their own business, even among their own kind. He often thought that was one of the greatest tragedies of their race's decline and subjugation.
the loss of curiosity, and the lack of knowledge required to simply survive in this cruel world. They held up their foolish hope that the Kij Tal, the Bajuman savior, would one day appear and free them all. But Blaine had always viewed this as nothing more than an excuse for not rising against their oppressors. They were waiting for the moment, waiting for the leader foretold by the ancient prophets. But where was the Kij Tal now? If a savior was ever to appear, wouldn't this be the day? Right now he had other things on his mind, as did the group of Bajuman novices. They have their own safety to consider. I have my future to face. A couple of times he was forced to slip into open doorways when he heard voices farther along the corridors, hallways, and staircases. Not hiding as such, not really, just keeping his presence silent. He waited until the priests or helpers walked by, then continued on his way. He wondered how many of Quandus's Bajuman would be dead by the end of the day. But he tried to shove that thought from his mind. In this hour of their greatest need, Blaine's hand had been forced at last. He had seen the phage fighting with unnatural strength and grace. He had seen that strange smudge of darkness around Purbristolo's eyes as he gave them silent orders to confront the city guard. He knew what he had seen, and he knew what he could do to show his people that he was no traitor to them or Lemuria. He eventually found his way to the secret passage and was soon walking the spiral and standing on the central piece of sea glass, hearing the breath of air and the almost imperceptible sound of the spiral staircase dropping open beneath his feet. Blaine took in a deep breath and inhaled the forbidden scents of this temple's deepest places. Blaine had never believed in the gods, but now, after so much investigation and secretive research, the sight of the phage had solidified a suspicion he had hoped was real. Now, he believed in magic.
Chapter 8. A strange calm had settled over Deimos after his encounter with Apex Euphraxia. He knew it might have been the spies' smoke that lingered in the air and coated the walls of the stone box where he'd been quartered. And if the spies had been helpful, he welcomed it. Mirren would not leave him here. She would do something to effect his release. Even branded and shamed, he trusted their love enough to know she would not abandon him. But that would take time, if she managed it at all. Mirren's influence only stretched so far, which left it to him to contemplate another plan, to watch and wait. Slaves in the household of the Apex had a hierarchy all their own, with the Praegis at the top, the maids and kitchen slaves below him, the spies of burners and coal shovelers next, and then the ones the nobles called muckers, who cleaned filthy bowls and pans, and who scrubbed shit and piss out of broken pipes and emptied chamber pots. In that hierarchy, Deimos fell somewhere beneath the lowliest mucker. He wasn't even welcome in the kitchen. Most of the household slaves treated him as invisible, speaking to him only to give orders. He had bleached vomit from carpets and thrust his own hands into a backed-up sewage pipe, and that had been on his first day working in the House of the Apex. Whatever reason the Apex had for hating him and his family name, she'd made sure the rest of her slaves felt it as well. They all bore brands, either the slave's brand or Bajuman's, but somehow he bore another, invisible to the naked eye, and they despised him for it, which made him wary of today's work. On the surface, it seemed less revolting than other tasks he'd been assigned. So why choose him, the most despised among Euphraxia's slaves? Now he understood. The task had been passed down from one tier to the next because the others were afraid of it. And no wonder. Deimos knelt on the filthy cellar floor with a rag tied over his nose and mouth. The air in this dark grotto at the back of the house hung thick and damp around him, a warm miasma of smoke and stink. There were four large coal hearths in different corners of the cellar, though the weather had not yet turned cold enough for them to be lit.
In Euphraxia's home, however, the spies at chimneys burned all year long, all day and night. There were six of them, much narrower than the hearths used for coal, and this filthy grotto contained the open mouths at the base of two of those spies at chimneys, as well as a coal hearth and a massive store of coal at the bottom of the chute used for its delivery. The spies' stores were vast and diverse and kept behind a thick, locked wooden door with iron strapping. Deimos had his upper body inside the open trap of a spies' chimney, his neck and shoulders aching from the 2 hours he'd already spent scraping years of accumulated rime off the stone. The whispers that made their way down through the hierarchy said the Apex had complained that the spies' smoke wafting through her curtained corridors had a sour tang. That was all it had taken. A sour tang. The Praegis, Vasto, had decided this ancient rime detritus must be tainting the scent of each day's burn, and thus it had to be removed. The perfect job for the one face nobody in the house wanted to see. In better days, Deimos had risen quickly in the ranks of the Navy, and in the estimation of his commanding officers, because he never shied away from work. Now he would have gladly given this task to another. With every scrape of the flat iron blade against the inside of the chimney, thick dust clouded around his head. His work disturbed generations of Spiza Gunge, old and thick and caked with mold, and there was no telling what hours of inhaling that dust might do to him. The stink of it choked him and muddled his thoughts. He paused now and then to withdraw from the chimney and clear his head. But he put his strength into the work. The only alternative would have been to refuse, and he knew Vasto would have relished any new opportunity to beat him. The Spiza made the edges of his world blur, and momentary introspections seemed to last for hours. Yet he somehow maintained his focus, or at least kept his hands working. Beads of sweat trickled down his forehead. Voices whispered in his brain, words of love from Mirren. Childhood assurances from his mother, barked commands from the officers of Admiral Haliardi's fleet, his own quiet prayers from years long past. He felt his heart beating in time with his efforts, and the whispers fell into the same cadence, until his life had diminished into nothing but this echo dance between muscle and memory. When something nudged his hip, it felt like nothing, barely there. The next nudge came harder, made his ribs hit the inner wall of the chimney, broke his rhythm. The blade slid sideways and he raked his knuckles. Deimos thrust himself backward out of the chimney and turned to face his attacker. The flat blade had gone dull, but he held it like a weapon. Mouse stood over him. Go on, try it. Take a swipe at me with that blade and I'll open your throat with it. Deimos wavered. He'd moved too fast with all the spiza he'd inhaled, and now his gut roiled and he felt himself blanch. He shook his head, trying to clear it, as his lips went dry. What do you want? Mouse's eyes narrowed. Are you ill? He felt the sweat on his forehead and the back of his neck, but he would not give her the satisfaction of revealing precisely how much the spiza had undone him. Deimos tossed the blade into the open mouth of the chimney. The corners of his vision blurred, and the colors of the dingy cellar seemed brighter and more vivid. But he took a deep breath and stared defiantly at Mouse. He'd averted his gaze enough in the aftermath of his father's execution. The murder of Linos Callistrate had turned his son into a boy again. But now Deimos the man had begun to remember himself. I'm fine, he replied. Your words are slurred. Too much spiza. Mouse sighed. You should have said something. I'd have gotten you to a window. The spiza they used in those chimneys 100 years ago was much more potent, and not nearly as refined as what is used now. There are tales of madness, of minds unraveling, and tales of those who saw the faces of the gods, he said, the words like moths fluttering from his lips. I know the stories. Her hand lashed out and he felt the crack of her knuckles across his face. But the pain was remote. Do not speak to me as if we're equals, she snapped. We will never be that. The words hung in the air as if they had substance,
the layers of their meaning ready to be peeled away and examined.
We were equals once, he said quietly. His voice brushed at the stone walls around them, and Mouse glanced over her shoulder as if to make sure no one would overhear before glaring at him.
Never equal, she said. Only too young and foolish to recognize what we were.
We were friends.
We were slave and master. If you think laughing together as children erases all the years of indifference that came afterward,
I don't.
Deimos drew a deep breath and let it out. A veil of glittering light seemed to fall upon the whole scene, and Mouse's eyes were brighter than before, as if the blue winter within them blew across the cellar.
Society bent us to its roles. Tradition forged us. But I was never cruel to you, Mouse. Cold, but never cruel.
Mouse struck him so hard across the face that he thought his cheekbone might have cracked. He rocked backward, staggered against the chimney, kicked over the bucket of spiza rime, and nearly hit the ground. The vivid colors were bleached from his vision, and the dreary gloom of the cellar returned. Mouse's knuckles had split and blood dripped from them as she loomed over him.
I'm sorry, Mouse said.
She hit him again. Deimos saw it coming. Confusion cost him a sliver of a moment, and he paid the price. Mouse struck him 3 times in quick succession, then hurled him against the stone wall. He fell in the spilled spiza dregs, the chalky dust of centuries coating his clothes and hands as he scrambled away. Mouse kicked him, but he turned with the blow and shot out his own foot and hooked her leg out from beneath her. She fell and he was on her. Deimos struck her twice before he saw the resignation in her pale eyes and he hesitated. A mistake. Mouse snapped out a kick, shot her heel into his balls, and Deimos went down again. Wheezing, he tried to curl up and protect himself, but she dragged him to his feet. Examining him as if searching for places he didn't appear bruised, she struck him again, just at the edge of his left eye, and he felt it begin to swell. Panting, Mouse said,
Your princess is on her way here.
Mirin. A flush of elation rushed through him.
Euphraxia wants Princess Mirin to see what her intrusion has cost you.
Vasto ordered that I be the one to beat you. Spiza had blunted the pain before, and now hope helped Deimos separate himself from his bleeding, bruised flesh.
Do what you must, he said.
He'd been in his share of brawls, proving himself a more than capable warrior and sailor. If he'd chosen to fight now, the moment of surprise no longer in Mouse's favor, he could have killed her. Instead, he would take whatever physical punishment he must endure in order to see Mirin. Mouse licked the blood from her knuckles, ready to come at him again, but a sudden clatter made them both turn in time to see a body tumbling down the old coal chute. Deimos rubbed a hand over his eyes and wondered just how much Spiza had affected him. But as he rose shakily to his feet, Mouse rushed toward the coal bin, and he knew he had not imagined this.
What are you doing, you little fool? She barked. What idiot thief would break into the home of the Apex?
The idiot thief struggled to right himself in the shifting coal, a thin arm flailing before he got hold of the edge of the bin and poked his head up. Smudged with black coal, his pale features were even more striking, his blue eyes more vivid. No more than 12 years of age, the skinny Bajuman looked stricken with fear. Tears rolled down his face, streaking clean lines through the coal smudge.
Mouse, the slave boy said.
No idiot thief, after all.
Tolliver? Mouse said, gaping in shock. What are you doing here? You can't... If you're caught, Euphraxia will claim you.
Tolliver, Deimos whispered, recognizing the boy. His mother had been a slave in the Calistrate home. When she'd died, the other slaves had taken to looking after the boy, so that he could remain among them. To his shame, Deimos did not recall the dead woman's name. Tolliver dropped his gaze, wiping at his tears, inclining his head in subservience to his former master.
No,
Mouse growled.
He is a slave now, just like me. You do not bow to him.
Tolliver glanced up doubtfully. Deimos walked toward them until he had come abreast of Mouse.
It's the truth, he said, showing the boy his brand. In this house, I am meant to bow to Mouse. But tell us, boy, what's got you so terrified?
You were supposed to stay with my uncle. You were supposed to stay hidden, Mouse said sadly.
Tolliver swiped at his tears, smearing coal dust. Then his face crumpled as he tried to speak, but sobbed instead. Mouse lifted him from the coal bin and held him as if he were her own son, shushing and comforting until he had his tears under control.
Your uncle is dead,
Tolliver said. Mouse raised a hand to her mouth to hide her horror. Tolliver glanced at Deimos, then back to Mouse.
They're all dead. The guard is moving through the city, executing every Bajaman they find. The queens ordered them to kill us. All of us.
Deimos wanted to argue, to say the queen would never give such an order. But that was the queen as she'd once been, not the woman who had executed his father. Yet it still seemed absurd.
That makes no sense, he said. The damage to the city's economy, to all of Qantas. It will take years for the noble families to recover.
The noble families? Mouse spat. There are many thousands of Bajaman on the main island. How long do you think it will take them to recover once they've had their heads removed?
Head ringing from the beating she'd delivered, and still muddled by Spized, Deimos knelt beside them.
As long as it will take for my father.
Your father was a prick, she rasped.
And yet he was my father. And Lysandra murdered him. Whatever madness has claimed her, we're all in danger because of it.
Deimos put a hand on Tolliver's shoulder. The boy flinched back, staring at him, stunned by this tiny expression of compassion.
They can't come for you here, Tolliver. Not in the Apex's home.
He's not even meant to be here, Mouse hissed. He can't stay or she'll—
Then we'll hide him, Deimos said. He's safer here than on the streets. And you're safer here than you would have been with Clan Calistrate. The Crown has no official authority in this house. For the city guard to take you, Euphraxia would have to surrender you.
Mouse held the boy tighter for a moment, then nodded.
First we hide him, she said. Then I'm going to clean myself up. If Euphraxia realizes you've struck me, she'll have you killed. She hates you, Deimos, for whatever reason. So let's move, and quickly. Any one of us might still be dead before the day is out.
Deimos waited in the piss-stinking corridor outside Mouse's room as she washed her hands and face in a basin. His mind had begun to clear a bit, enough that the throbbing pain of the beating she'd given him broke through. In her doorless room, she stripped off her tunic and replaced it with one devoid of any blood. Her muscled torso had been made hard by years of hard work, and he saw scars that were not fresh, wounds that could only have been given to her in the Calistrate household. It hardened Deimos in a way he'd never imagined, hardened him to his own life, to his own family, to the traditions whose destruction he'd been mourning. They'd hidden Tolliver in the one place nobody would look, Deimos's cell. Only Mouse and Deimos ever went there now. In time, they would find another place for him. There were other Bajaman slaves in the house, and they would have to be warned. Surely they would help. But that was for later. Mouse emerged from her room and led him to the Praegis's room. Vasto stood outside his own door and looked Deimos up and down with a sneer.
Only cuts and bruises, the Praegis said, disappointed. I was hoping for some broken bones at least, Mouse.
I don't want to do his work for him while he heals.
Vasto considered this, then waved her away.
Go. The princess has already arrived and the Apex is impatient to have her gone.
Yes, Praegis.
Then she was gone, and Deimos found himself standing in the corridor with the Praegis, eyes downcast, paying obeisance to a slave who despised him for his noble birth.
Vasto knocked once and entered. Deimos followed with his head down, still able to taste his own blood from the beating Mouse had given him. He held his left hand over his right, covering his brand, yearning for a moment with Mirin but hating for her to see him brought low.
Well, he heard Euphraxia say, at least the time I've been waiting here was time well spent for my slave.
Mirin said his name, anguish in her voice, and he heard the rustle of her clothes as she rushed toward him.
No, Euphraxia barked. You will be seated.
Deimos snapped his head up to stare at her. When he began to speak, forbidden unless he had his owner's permission, Mirin was the one who hushed him.
Did you just command the crown to sit? She inquired, taking a step toward Euphraxia.
Mirin's skin had a dusty, almost ghostly quality, and her hair was in disarray. Everything about her spoke of frayed nerves. And yet as she glared at the apex, towering over the much older woman, she might have been forged of iron.
This is my home, Euphraxia said. The crown has no authority here.
Leave this room, the princess said.
Euphraxia flinched. I've just reminded you, you are apex of the faith, yes? Your home is meant to be treated with the same sovereignty as the Temple of Four. But rules once thought to be forged in fire and carved in stone are crumbling all around us, as I'm sure you know.
The Bajuman slaughter?
The Apex shrugged, unconcerned.
And I'm aware that the Queen has been testing the loyalties of the noble families. She suspects treachery among them, and I share her fears. Your mother has put her trust in me, and I in her. And the value I place in that trust is the only reason I allowed you into my home again.
With the apex only feet away, Mirin reached out and touched Deimos' face, kissed his bruised cheek. For a moment he could see just how much the sight of his blood unsettled her.
How dare you, Euphraxia whispered. He is my slave.
I've always wondered how it is you're allowed household slaves, Mirin said. From novice to high order, the rest of your priesthood abase themselves. The very idea of a slave undermines what it means to serve the Four. And yet here you are, the apex from whom the greatest devotion of all ought to be expected. With slaves, and spiza, and luxury.
What are you playing at, girl? Euphraxia said. You need no lesson from me in the relationship of the apex to the crown. I'm the bridge between the royal line and the faith, between the people and the Four. I'm part of both worlds, and you have already outstayed your welcome.
Mirin reached out and took Deimos' hand. Whatever knowledge gave her strength, he drew from it and lifted his gaze in defiance again, staring at the apex. His owner. Your good relationship with the crown no longer depends on earning my mother's trust, Mirin said. Understanding dawned on Euphraxia's face.
The queen has passed then. Tragic, but not unforeseen.
Only a short time ago, Mirin said. As I left the palace to come to you.
I will pray that the Four welcome her into their realms and offer my condolences to your brother, Prince Aris. Now King Aris.
That will be very difficult, as my brother is also dead. Gone before my mother, in fact.
Deimos stared at her. Mirin.
She squeezed his hand but kept her focus on Euphraxia.
Your sister, the apex began.
My queen.
And yours, Mirin corrected.
Many things will change now. Everything might change. And even if Queen Fila continues respecting the House of the Apex as part of the sovereign property of the priesthood, unless you choose this place as your prison, you will leave it one day. And whatever protections you enjoy do not exist outside these walls.
Euphraxia stood rigid.
Hate radiated from her. She pointed at Deimos. That is mine. My slave, by all the laws of Quandis and by the decree of the Queen. Unless Queen Phila wishes to undermine her mother's decree, it is my wish.
This confirmation put a smug smile on Euphraxia's face.
Well, princess, until then?
Until then you will see that he is not harmed again, by your order or any other.
Euphraxia said nothing, only smiled.
Mirren stepped close to the apex. Now get the fuck out of the room. At first, Deimos only held her. In spite of his bruises and the blood on his face and clothing, even in spite of his brand and his humiliation, Mirren had suffered far worse, learning of her brother's death and then losing her mother on the same day. All the spite and hatred he had been nursing toward Queen Lysandra vanished upon hearing of her death. The pain of his father's execution remained, and he had nowhere to expend his grief. No one left to blame. Mirren kissed his cheek, kissed his lips, but he tried to pull away when she turned over his hand and went to kiss the symbol burned there.
No,
he whispered. It's not right.
It's a scar, she said.
We all have them. Not this one.
Please let's not compare our suffering,
Mirren said quietly.
What little time we have together now must be our medicine, not further injury.
She was right, of course, as she always seemed to be.
I'm sorry,
he said, and he kissed the top of Mirren's head and held her quietly for a long minute, until she steadied herself and gently pushed him away, holding him at arm's length.
We must speak, she said. Euphraxia won't forgive the insults of today, and there's no way to predict what she'll do now. Her faith runs deep, but in her way she's as mad as—
Mirren left the words unspoken, closing her eyes tightly a moment, but Deimos heard them in his own mind. As mad as your mother, he thought.
Surely everything will change now, he said quietly. Phila keeps her own counsel, and she despises me.
She doesn't like your arrogance, but she doesn't despise you.
She despises me because once upon a time she was the object of your adoration.
And then you fell in love. Mirren gave a nod. All right, that's probably true.
Regardless, Deimos went on. I've never doubted her love for you. She's cold, but not heartless.
I wish I had your confidence. Once I would have, but now, there are days I fear I don't know my sister at all.
And she's Queen Phila now. She is the crown, and the crown needs no approval.
His heart sank.
You're saying she won't free me, that my mother and brother and I are to remain slaves, even though Phila knows you and I were to be married? Yes, she's not fond of me, but does your happiness mean nothing to her?
Mirren had flinched at his words, now her eyes filled with sorrow.
My love, I thought you knew. I'd have said it first before anything.
What? Deimos said.
What is it you thought I knew?
She put a hand on his chest, fingers splayed as if to feel the beat of his heart.
I'm not the only one who's lost a brother.
Deimos felt himself shrink.
Cyrus,
his injuries on the night of your father's execution were too dire. He lingered for a day, and then
he died a prisoner, before he could be sold into slavery.
Deimos said, his own voice hollow in his eyes.
Your mother has taken it poorly, Mirren went on. My friends in Clan Dachlan tell me she's ailing, though she's safe enough for the moment.
Clan Dachlan? Bought her?
Deimos asked, though he knew the answer and understood. His mother had friends among the Dachlans. If they'd bought her, it had been more for their protection than the status conferred by trophy slaves of such notoriety.
At auction, Mirren confirmed.
They outbid Euphraxia.
Deimos nodded, taking it all in. So much death and so much fear in both of their lives. But he and Mirren would endure. He promised himself that,
What will Phila do now? He asked. The new queen is nothing if not cunning, Mirin replied. She won't simply wave away our mother's decrees, because to do so would undermine the strength of the crown. But she will be methodical and, if needed, ruthless. She has promised to free you and your mother. But not yet. Phila doesn't trust Euphraxia. She wants to know the secrets of this house. Deimos licked his dry lips and tasted spies and blood. I'm to be her spy, for a time, Mirin said. She needs to understand Euphraxia's loyalties. She wants news on the Apex's reaction to her becoming queen. And as insurance against any negative reactions, anything you might learn of Euphraxia that can be used against her will all be currency for Phila, Deimos finished. Leverage. If the queen has cause to go against the Apex. I suppose so, Mirin said. Our fates are in Phila's hands. We have no choice but to obey and be patient. When the time comes, Deimos, and she fulfills her promise to free you, that's when we run. Run, together, you and I, and your mother if I can free her too. The idea of fleeing Lartha and Quandis was a shock to him. All his life he'd wanted to be a warrior like his father. His time under Admiral Halardi's command had helped him to forge his own identity. He'd had a future mapped out in his head. But with everything that had happened, and these new events that had fractured the crown and must surely be sending shockwaves through the land, he saw that Mirin was right. It might be the only way for them to have the life together that they longed for. The beatings will continue, Deimos said. Euphraxia hates me, for reasons I don't yet understand. I can endure them, but she'll do everything she can to keep you from me now.
No doubt. But can you find a way to get messages out, and for me to get messages in?
Deimos thought of the tear-streaked coal smudges on Tolliver's face, and Mouse's wintry eyes. She'd beaten him more than once, but he'd seen her regret and anger, and he'd had a tiny taste of what it meant to be a slave, to be beneath notice. Perhaps, he said, his thoughts racing ahead. He kissed Mirin's hands. But tell Phila I have a condition.
Deimos,
you are aware of the Bajamin purge your mother ordered.
Of course.
Queen Phila must stop it. Rescind the execution decree. And she must keep the city guard away from this house.
She'll never agree, Mirin said. I've just told you she won't want to undermine the primacy of the crown.
The blood of the four runs through us, Deimos. The crown is meant to be infallible.
If Phila suggests that our mother's decree was wrong, the public will be encouraged to question
Mirin, Deimos said softly. Phila's fears are not my concern. Our future, and that of my family, is. Tell her my price.
She'll have you killed herself if I put it to her that way.
Then tell her the truth, which is that the only way for me to guarantee that I'll be able to get messages in and out of this house is if she spares the lives of the Bajumen. If they're all dead, my presence here is useless to her.
A heavy fist pounded on the door, and then it opened without further warning. Vasto stood there. He bowed his head in obeisance to the princess, but his manner belied that gesture of respect.
My mistress tells me the slave Deimos must return to work.
Mirin kissed Deimos tenderly, and he winced from the bruising on his face. She told him that she loved him, and then she left.
When Mirin had gone, Vasto stepped inside and closed the door, and the day's beatings recommenced.
Alone, hidden away and somewhere that felt apart from the rest of Lartha and Quandis, rage and grief coursed through Blaine. The deep shadows of this subterranean place were his only company, and he felt no shame in letting them see and hear his tears. It felt good to let such emotions flow. As he descended the spiral staircase into levels where only the high order priests were allowed, his vision and hearing were blurred by his own quiet sobbing. Each time he tried to blink away the tears, he saw the phage, and the signs around Per Ristolo's eyes that could only have been magic. The priest wraiths had moved with unnatural grace, speed, and strength, and it had been Ristolo guiding their actions. Blaine was